You're listening to continuing coverage in the Las Vegas Reporter murder trial of Robert Telles from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
I'll sit down. Thank you. Looks like we have all our jurors present. Anything before we can jury panel in?
No, on behalf of the state, Your Honor.
You can approach monetarily. Yes.
I'm sorry. Okay. Wait.
Okay.
Can you bring the camera in? Can you come in if you'll please remain standing? Because the clerk's going to administer the oath of service. Does the state stipulate to the presence of the panel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Drasovich?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, if you'll please raise your right hand so the clerk can administer the oath.
You and each of you do solemnly swear that you will well and truly try the case at issue and a true verdict render according to the evidence. So help you God.
Yes.
You may be seated.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, you are admonished that no juror may declare to a fellow juror any fact related to this case of his or her own knowledge, and if any juror discovers during the trial or after the jury's retired that he or she or any other juror has personal knowledge of any fact in controversy in this case, he or she shall disclose the situation to myself in the absence of the other jurors. This means that if you learn during the course of this trial that you are acquainted with the facts of this case or the witnesses and you have not previously told me of this relationship, you must then declare that fact to me. Again, I want to remind you that you communicate to the court either in the courtroom in the presence of both sides or through Officer Hawks. I mean, we're going to be together for the next couple of weeks, so we will inevitably see you in the hallway, in the elevators, and maybe even coming in and out of the courthouse. Please do not be offended should we not acknowledge you. We're all just maintaining our ethical obligation to maintain the integrity of the jury system. So outside the courtroom, it's only Officer Hawks that's permitted to have any communication with you. What I will now say is intended to serve as an introduction to the trial of this case. It is not a substitute for the detailed instructions on the law, which I will give you at the close of the case and before you retire to consider your verdict. This is a criminal case commenced by the state of Nevada, which I may sometimes refer to as the state, against the defendant, Mr. Telles. The case is based on an indictment. The clerk will now read the indictment to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury and state the plea of the defendant to that indictment.
District Court, Clark County, Nevada, the State of Nevada, Plaintiff versus Robert Tellis, Defendant. Case number C-368935, Department number 12, Indictment. State of Nevada, County of Clark, the defendant above named Robert Tellis, accused by the Clark County Grand Jury of the crime of murder with use of a deadly weapon, victim 60 years of age or older, felony, committed at and within the County of Clark, State of Nevada, on or about the second day of September 2022 as follows. Did willfully and lawfully with malice aforethought kill Jeffrey Gehrman, who is 60 years of age or older, with use of a deadly weapon, to wit, a knife, by stabbing the said Jeffrey Gehrman multiple times about the body, the said killing having been 1, willful, deliberate, and premeditated, and or 2, perpetrated by lying in wait for the said Jeffrey Gehrman, and or 3, perpetrated by abuse of an older person, dated this 19th day of October 2022, Stephen B. Wilson, Clark County District Attorney, signed by Pamela Weckerly, Chief Deputy District Attorney, to which the defendant has pled not guilty.
Thank you. This case is based on the indictment, which has just been read to you by the clerk of the court. You should distinctly understand that the indictment is simply a charge and that it is not in any sense evidence of the allegations it contains. The defendant has entered a plea of not guilty to the indictment. The state, therefore, has a burden of proving each of the elements as alleged in their charging document by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. As the defendant sits here today, he is presumed innocent. The purpose of this trial is to determine whether the state of Nevada will meet their burden of proof. It is your primary responsibility as jurors to find and determine the facts. Under our system of criminal procedure, you are the sole judge of the facts. You are to determine the facts from the testimony you hear and the other evidence, including exhibits introduced in court. It is up to you to determine the inferences which you feel may be properly drawn from the evidence. The parties may sometimes present objections to some of the testimony or other evidence. It is the duty of a lawyer to object to evidence which he or she believes may not properly be offered, and you should not be prejudiced in any way against a lawyer, who makes objections on behalf of the party he or she represents. At times, I may sustain objections or direct that you disregard certain testimony or exhibits. You must not consider any evidence to which an objection has been sustained or which I have instructed you to disregard. Anything you may have seen or heard outside the courtroom is not evidence and must also be disregarded. Remember, statements, arguments, and opinions of counsel are not evidence in the case. However, if the attorneys stipulate as to the existence of a fact, you must accept the stipulation as evidence and regard that fact as proved. You must not speculate to be true any insinuation suggested by a question asked a witness. A question is not evidence and may be considered only as it supplies meaning to the answer. You must not be influenced in any degree by any personal feeling of sympathy for or prejudice against the state or the defendant. Both sides are entitled to the same fair and impartial consideration. In considering the weight and value of the testimony of any witness, you may take into consideration the appearance, attitude, and behavior of the witness, the interests of the witness in the outcome of the case, if any, the relation of the witness to the defendant or to the state, the inclination of the witness to speak truthfully or not, and the probability or improbability of the witness's statements, and all of the facts and circumstances in evidence. Thus, you may give the testimony of any witness just such weight and value as you believe the testimony of the witness is entitled to receive. There are two kinds of evidence, direct and circumstantial. Direct evidence is testimony by a witness about what that witness personally saw or heard or did. Circumstantial evidence is testimony or exhibits which are proof of a particular fact from which, if proven, you may infer the existence of a second fact. You may consider both direct and circumstantial evidence in deciding this case. The law permits you to give equal weight to both, but it is for you to decide how much weight to give to any evidence. Opening statements and closing arguments of the attorneys are intended to help you in understanding the evidence and applying the law, but they are not evidence. No statement, ruling, remark, or comment which I make during the course of this trial is intended to indicate my opinion as to how you should decide the case or to influence you in any way in your determination of the facts. At times, I may even ask questions of witnesses. If I do so, it is for the purpose of bringing out matters which I feel should be brought out and not in any way to indicate my opinion about the facts or to indicate the weight I feel you should give to the testimony of the witness. I may also find it necessary to admonish the attorneys, and if I do, you should not show prejudice against a lawyer or his or her client because I have found it necessary to admonish him or her. Until the case is submitted to you, you must not discuss it with anyone, even with your fellow jurors. After it is submitted to you, you must discuss it only in the jury room with your fellow jurors. It is important that you keep an open mind and not decide any issue in the case until the entire case has been submitted to you under instructions from the court. The trial will proceed in the following manner. The deputy district attorney will make an opening statement, which is an outline to help you understand what the state expects to prove. Next, the defendant's attorney may, but is not required, to make an opening statement. Opening statement serves an introduction to the evidence which the party making the statement intends to prove. The state will then present its evidence, and counsel for the defendant may cross-examine the witnesses. Following the state's case, the defendant may present evidence, and the deputy district attorney may cross-examine the witnesses. However, as I have said, the defendant is not obligated to present any evidence. After all of the evidence has been presented, I will instruct you on the law. After the instructions on the law have been read to you, each side will have the opportunity to present oral argument. What is said in closing argument is not evidence. The arguments are designed to summarize and interpret the evidence. Since the state has a burden of proving the defendant guilty by proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the state has the right to open and close the arguments. After the arguments have been completed, you will then retire to deliberate upon your verdict. Again, let me remind you that until the case is submitted to you, do not talk to each other about anyone who has anything to do with it until the end of the case, when you go to the jury room to decide upon your verdict. Do not talk with anyone else about this case or about anyone who has anything to do with it until the trial has ended and you have been discharged as jurors. Anyone else includes members of your family and your friends. You may tell them that you are a juror in a criminal case, but don't tell them anything else about it until after you've been discharged by the court. Do not let anyone talk to you about the case or about anyone who has anything to do with it. If someone should try to talk to you, please report that to me immediately by contacting the court marshal. Do not read any news stories or articles or listen to any radio or television reports about the case or about anyone who has anything to do with it. As jurors, you will be given the opportunity to ask written questions of the witnesses called to testify in this case. You are not encouraged to ask large numbers of questions because that is the primary responsibility of counsel. Questions may be asked, but only in the following manner. After both lawyers have finished questioning the witness, and only at this time, if there are additional questions you would like to ask the witness, you may then seek permission to ask that witness a written question. Should you desire to ask a question, write your question down with your juror number on a full sheet of clean paper and raise your hand. All questions from jurors must be factual in nature and designed to clarify information already presented. In addition, jurors must not place undue weight on the responses to their questions. The court marshal will pick up your question and present it to the court. All questions must be directed to the witness and not to the lawyers or to the court. After consulting with counsel, I would then determine if your question is legally proper. If I determine that your question may properly be asked, I will ask the question. No adverse inference should be drawn if the court does not allow a particular question. I do follow that procedure pretty strictly, so you'll know when it's your opportunity to ask written questions. When the witness is done being questioned by both sides, I'm going to turn to the witness, I'm going to thank them for being here, and I'm going to excuse them from their subpoena. If you want to ask a written question, just please get my attention. I will have the witness stay here until you have an opportunity to write your question down and present it to the court. What I don't do is, after I do excuse a witness from their subpoena, I will not require them to come back to the courthouse to answer a written question by a juror. So just please get my attention before I do excuse that juror if you do have a written question. Also, you have been, when you came in, there were notebooks on your chairs. Those are your notebooks. They must remain in the courtroom at all times until you go back to deliberate upon your verdict. In the front, there's a pocket that you can open up. There's a sheet of paper, and that just gives you information about where you are and phone numbers in case you have any type of emergency when we're out of session. You can take that piece of paper with you when you leave. Everything else must stay in the courtroom at all times. The instructions I had given you are in there. The admonishment that I'm required to give you every time we take a recess is in there as well. And if you need to refer to the procedure to ask written questions, that is in there as well. Also, at the very end, there should be some paper there for you to take notes. You're not required to take notes, but you may take notes. When you go back to deliberate upon your verdict, you will not have a transcript. So it will be your memories collectively, and any notes that you have taken, you'll be able to share those and refer to those during your deliberations. At the end of the day, the court marshal is under court order to collect those notebooks. He puts them in a safe place. I assure you, I will not let anyone have access to those notebooks. They will be kept strictly confidential. Your notes will be kept confidential. And when you come in the next morning, your notebooks will be on your chairs waiting for you. At this time, the state of Nevada may address the jury panel in their opening statement.
Thank you, Your Honor. All day long on September the 2nd of 2022, Roy and Holly Bailey were concerned about their neighbor across the street. He was a man by the name of Jeffrey Gehrman. The Baileys and Gehrman had been neighbors for over 20 years, so they had come to know each other's habits. And on the 2nd of September of 2022, the Baileys noticed that Mr. Gehrman's garage door was open and his car was parked in his garage, and that was unusual. They called him, they texted him all day on the 2nd of September, and they didn't get a response. Finally, on the evening of the 2nd, Mr. Bailey went over and just shut the garage for Jeff just to protect his house. But at that time, they still hadn't received any response from their calls or texts. On September the 3rd, still having no response, Roy Bailey walked over to Jeff Gehrman's house and was trying to check on him. He found his neighbor, Jeff Gehrman, on the side of his house. Mr. Gehrman was over 60 years old at the time, and so initially it was thought that maybe he had had a medical episode. Soon after, though, it was discovered that he had been murdered. Mr. Gehrman had sharp force injuries to multiple parts of his body all over. He also, when they found him on September the 3rd, had signs of decomposition, indicating that he had not been killed on the 3rd, but was killed earlier. Investigators assessed the crime scene and took note of several things. One of the things they took note of was that Mr. Gehrman's phone was in his pocket. His car keys were in his pocket as well. His wallet with money was on his person as well, suggesting to investigators that robbery was not a motive in this case. Investigators looked around the surrounding area of where Mr. Gehrman was found, and they noticed damage to the bushes in the area of where the body was. They looked closer and actually saw blood on some of the bushes in the area by Mr. Gehrman's body, and they noticed it on some of the outdoor decorations as well, and they took note of that in their investigation. There appeared to be blood on some of those items. Detectives and crime scene analysts looked inside Mr. Gehrman's house as well. Inside the house, there was no sign of forced entry. There was no sign of struggle. All of his valuables were present inside the house. Oops, let me back up just a little bit.
Just the court's indulgence.
Okay, thank you. Sorry about that. As I was saying, detectives and investigators checked the inside of Mr. Gehrman's house. There was no sign of forced entry. All his valuables were present, and there was no indication that anything had been disturbed anywhere in his house. So the scene ends up being kind of that side area of his house, those bushes, and where his body was. And as I discussed before, his car was present in his garage as well. Investigators did find some clues as to a timeline of the last hours of Mr. Gehrman's life. They looked through his trash and they found a receipt that was dated on September the 2nd, and it was a receipt for Roberto's Taco Shop, and the transaction time was 9:03 a.m. So detectives go and pull the video from Roberto's Taco Shop to see if they can find Jeff Gehrman present, and he's alive and well at that time. The video time at Roberto's was incorrect, so they went by the cash register receipt, the transaction time, which was 9:03 a.m. On the 2nd, and they watched, and he bought his food and went back to the car, and it was uneventful. One thing that was lucky for detectives was that the Baileys, a couple that lived across the street from Mr. Gehrman, had a home surveillance system, and one of their cameras actually pointed to the front of Jeff Gehrman's house. So they pull that video, and they see a figure come to the side of Mr. Gehrman's house. And the figure, as you saw, is dressed in orange. And that person stays lying in wait for Jeff Gehrman. Mr. Gehrman opens his garage and goes over to that side yard, and he's attacked. After killing Jeff Gehrman, the assailant walks down from the side yard and goes back down Jeff Gehrman's street and just walks away. He's picked up on additional surveillance video a little bit further down the street, and eventually there's surveillance of this individual seen getting into a maroon Yukon Denali SUV. And so police try to collect all available video that is present in the neighborhood. Meanwhile, Jeff Gehrman's body was transported for an autopsy at the Clark County Medical Examiner's office. When his body was at the office, the cause of death was determined to be multiple sharp force injuries. A crime scene analyst attended the autopsy and collected fingernail clippings and scrapings from Jeff Gehrman's hands to see if there was foreign DNA present. Those samples were taken to Metro's DNA lab, and foreign DNA was detected in the right fingernail clippings of Jeff Gehrman. There was foreign DNA collected, but no one knew who it belonged to. So the murder happens on September the 2nd. Mr. Gehrman's body is found on September the 3rd. After that, Metro released through their public information officer images of that assailant and of the vehicle. So after Metro released those images to the public asking for help if anybody recognized the vehicle or anyone recognized the individual, they get a lot of calls. A lot of calls come in. And some of the calls they get are about an individual by the name of Robert Tellis, the defendant. At the time, Mr. Tellis was the elected public administrator for Clark County, and a public administrator, when someone dies, sometimes handles the property and looking for next of kin in order to apportion property after someone's death. And in 2022, Mr. Tellis was running for re-election for his post as the Clark County Administrator. And detectives learned that Jeff Gehrman had written a series of unflattering articles about Robert Tellis. In those news stories, Gehrman alleged that Mr. Tellis had engaged in an inappropriate relationship with a coworker. He alleged that he was a bad manager and that he engaged in favoritism and bullying in the workplace. That was the first article. Mr. Gehrman wrote a second article saying that another individual had to be appointed to the public administrator's office in order to take over the management, alleging that Mr. Tellis was a poor manager. Soon after those articles ran in June, Mr. Tellis lost his primary election for public administrator, and Mr. Gehrman wrote about that as well. Mr. Tellis responded to the articles written by Mr. Gehrman and claimed they were politically motivated, that they were unfair, and he generally disputed what was alleged in those articles. And following this post by Robert Tellis, Jeff Gehrman wrote another article about Robert Tellis, alleging many of the things that I had previously discussed. Mr. Tellis also engaged in, saying unfavorable things about Mr. Gehrman on Twitter. He accused Mr. Gehrman of going through his trash. He accused Mr. Gehrman of being a bully. He accused Mr. Gehrman of threatening him all over Twitter, which I guess is now X. Meanwhile, the police do more investigation, and they learn that the Tellis family has a maroon Yukon Denali SUV, and that is important obviously because that is seen in the video connected to the assailant. So the search for video, where it sort of started in Gehrman's neighborhood, now focuses kind of on the areas in between Tellis's neighborhood and Gehrman's neighborhood. And this is not just like, hey, is there any video out there? They really, really look for video. They have a grid, they assign officers, and everybody is looking for any video of this SUV between the two residences. Now, the police still had their timeline where they go back and they knew that Jeff Gehrman was alive and well at 9:03 a.m. on the 2nd. And they map out the route between Robert Tellis's house and Jeff Gehrman's house. Now, Mr. Tellis lives on a street called Spanish Steps. And to get out of his neighborhood, you go down a street called Silk Tassel. And then you can turn on a street called Red Hills Road. And on the morning of the murder of September the 2nd, officers found video of Mr. Tellis's SUV leaving his neighborhood on the morning of the murder. To give you some reference point, Mr. Gehrman's residence, as I said, is on Bronze Circle. Streets in his area include Wintergreen Drive and Rock Springs Drive. And detectives go all over that area to see if there's any video that they can find of that Yukon in the neighborhood. And they find on the morning of the murder that that Yukon was present on Rock Springs Drive, and they collect that video. Again, another, the street that, the cross street for Bronze Circle, Mr. Gehrman Street, is Wintergreen Drive. They collect video from Wintergreen Drive as well, and they see the red SUV or maroon SUV in the area as well. They see that maroon SUV interact with kind of workers at a construction site. And the SUV does not go in a direct linear line anywhere. It's picked up on cameras at different times in the area of Jeff Gehrman's neighborhood. One of the cameras picks up the driver of the SUV. You can kind of see that orange clothing, and it appears that the driver is the only one present. At some point, the cameras in that neighborhood pick up an individual, this individual, getting out of the car. And the individual is seen on Wintergreen, walking past Bronze Circle, going south on Wintergreen, going north, kind of meandering around the neighborhood near Jeff Gehrman's house. Ultimately, the individual is seen traveling in the direction of Jeff Gehrman's house on Bronze Circle, going further towards Gehrman's house on Bronze Circle, and then ultimately to the side of the house. And then in sequence, after the assailant goes to the side of the house, that's when Mr. Gehrman opens his garage door, he goes to the side, and he's attacked. The assailant leaves Mr. Gehrman there in the rocks, has his bag with him, and walks down the street. He goes further down the street toward Wintergreen, and he ultimately goes back to that maroon SUV. That maroon SUV, though, then proceeds south on Wintergreen, and it actually heads back in the direction of Gehrman's house. And you can kind of see it parked in front. The individual gets out, goes back towards where the body is, and then the individual returns back to the Yukon. The Yukon leaves Bronze Circle, the cul-de-sac for Jeff Gehrman. It goes back on Wintergreen Drive. It goes west on Washington. It goes on Rampart. It goes on Apple. And it goes back to Silk Tassel and Mr. Tellis's neighborhood. So with this video evidence and the evidence of the conflict between Mr. Gehrman and Mr. Tellis, the police seek a search warrant on September the 7th, and they want to get a DNA sample from Mr. Tellis. They want to seize his phone, and they also want to search his house. On September 7th, the police make contact with Mr. Tellis, and they photograph him all over. In particular, they photograph his hands, and they notice on one of his fingers he has a Band-Aid. They ask him to remove that Band-Aid, and he has a cut injury on one of his fingers. While detectives are photographing and getting that DNA sample from Mr. Tellis, other detectives go to Mr. Tellis's house and execute a search warrant there. So they go to the house that very same day on September the 7th, and some of the detectives are looking through the living room area of the house, and they're kind of focused on the end of the couch. Sort of underneath, they see a shoe, and there's actually a Ziploc bag on the right side of the photo. They examine the shoe. They find the companion shoe, but that shoe has been cut in half and sort of destroyed. And the bag, that baggie that was underneath that couch, actually contains pieces of the shoe as well. So they collect that evidence. And the reason why that was important for them is they compared it to the shoes worn by that assailant on Bronze Circle on September the 2nd. They don't just search in the house, they search in the garage as well, and there's a gray kind of tub in the garage that sort of stores stuff, and they take a closer look, and they look at that bag there, and they photograph it and impound it, and they believe the bag is significant in their search because the assailant was carrying a bag that's exactly like the one they found in Mr. Tellis's house. So they find the shoes, they find the bag. They do a search in this garage, which is quite crowded with stuff. And on this, at the bottom of this red tool cabinet, they find a bag from, like a grocery bag from Sprouts. And inside that bag, they find a hat that has been cut up as well. And the hat, of course, is significant because it has the same identifying characteristics as the hat worn by the assailant. So this is all happening on September the 7th. Detectives return Mr. Tellis back to his house on September the 7th, and they actually rushed to process his DNA sample that same day. And it's determined that that foreign DNA that was found in those fingernail clippings taken from autopsy of Jeff Gehrman, that foreign DNA is consistent with Robert Tellis. So they go back to his residence with the intent of taking him into custody for the murder of Jeff Gehrman. And they come to find eventually that he has inflicted injuries on himself, a suicide attempt, and they have to transport him to the hospital for treatment, but he is taken into custody. After that occurs, remember how I said that they took his phone as well? They're able to see some of the messages that occurred between Jeff Gehrman and Robert Tellis. One of those messages is from Mr. Gehrman on May the 10th. You can see it at the bottom of 2022, where Mr. Gehrman says, "Hi, this is Jeff Gehrman from the Review Journal. I'm putting together a story on your office. I've talked to several employees who have said you have created a hostile work environment. They also say you've had an inappropriate relationship with one of your staffers, and I very much wanted to talk to you and sort of get your side of the story." After that message was sent, Robert Tellis actually does agree to be interviewed by Jeff Gehrman, and he invites him to the public administrator's office, and he sits down with him for an interview. And this is the story that ran digitally for the Review Journal.
"The Clark County Public Administrator's Office has been mired in turmoil.
Internal dissension for 2 years, with workers claiming emotional stress,
bullying, and favoritism. Robert Tellis, who leads the office, has also faced allegations of an inappropriate relationship with a co-worker, Roberta Lee Kennett. In an interview with Review Journal investigative reporter Jeff Gehrman, Tellis disputed several complaints."
"What is your reaction to the allegations from these employees that you have created a hostile environment in this office?"
"Yeah, you know, I earlier introduced you to the other 7 team members, and they're folks who have all come with a great attitude, and they work hard. And together, them and I, we are what is making the difference with the performance of this office. I've done my best to try to make everyone happy, but again, it's described you within a certain framework, and people just cannot get to do whatever they want. You know, and it's unfortunate that, you know, we've got some people who were here from before who were basically trying to railroad me. And again, you meet those other folks, you know, they're happy, they're dedicated, and we're just here to do a good job."
Tellis, who's up for re-election in the June primary, blames a handful of old-timers for claims about a hostile environment in the office.
"And again, no matter what type of gestures I try to make to smooth things over, to make sure that they're happy, you know, they just don't, you know, it's nonstop. And again, like I said, it's hard for me to make sure that I am a cheerleader for the folks who are doing really good work when I've got these other folks who are constantly, you know, surveilling me, constantly trying to untie the office. But, you know, we're doing it, but it's hard."
Tellis denied allegations of any improper relationship with Lee Kennett.
"When you hear people raise up these allegations about your personal relationship that you have, what do you say to people about that?"
"Honestly, it's not true. So I'm, you know, all of my friends, all my family know how much I love my wife. And if you look at, you know, obviously you can't talk to people that do it on a daily basis. You know, like, but from my social media, from everything, you can see that I am about nothing but justice, fairness, and just being a good person. And it sickens me, it destroys me that somebody would even level like accusations like that, because it's, I don't know, it's unreal. It's unreal the lengths that they're going to. They don't have any qualms trying to ruin my personal life
The digital version also included a link with some video of Mr. Tellis and the alleged the person he was allegedly having an inappropriate relationship with. So after this story ran, Mr. Tellis contacts Jeff Gehrman, and he's upset. He tells Mr. Gehrman, "I don't know what to say. I told you about how much this has all impacted me. You heard from employees who are being harassed by these people. Provided you, I think he threw your proof
proof that I was doing my best to actually smooth things over after I had to make hard decisions. Still, you wrote an article that makes me sound like I'm the guilty one.
That was not fair and balanced. So what happens after that?
Mr. Gehrman contacts Robert Tellis again, and this time the communication is about the county deciding to appoint another person within the public administrator's office to help run things. Mr. Gehrman messages Mr. Tellis, I understand that Mike Murphy has been brought in by the county, hired by a county as a consultant to work at in the office with you guys for a while, and I wanted to see if you had any kind of comment about that.
Mr. Tellis messages
back to Mr. Gehrman, I will be providing it to you this evening. Later on, Mr. Tellis posts that statement that I had shown you earlier, where he says politically motivated, none of the allegations are true, this is unfair, I'm being unfairly attacked. All of the things alleged in those articles are false. And what happens after that? Well, Mr. Gehrman writes the story about the consultant being appointed at the public administrator's office. After those two stories run, Mr. Gehrman contacts Tellis again. He says, I'm putting together another story on your office. This is now in June the 16th. This has to do with the letter you posted on your campaign website addressing the hostile work allegation. Employees view this as a threat of retaliation and have reported it to human resources. I'd like to get your comment. And Mr. Tellis responds back, it's fine, at this point they've won, do what you'd like. And of course after that, Mr. Tellis loses his primary election, so he will no longer be one way or another in, as of 2023, the public administrator. Another thing that detectives found in Mr. Tellis's phone is something associated with like a phone extraction. So when you have a cell phone, it can be downloaded by this program called Cellebrite, and it'll download a lot of the data in your phone. And one of the things that was downloaded from Mr. Tellis's phone is files that he accessed on Google Maps. And you can see there are thumbnail photos associated with those maps that he downloaded. And it's probably hard to see because they're little, the thumbnails of what that picture, those two pictures are of. But here's a bigger version, and it should look familiar to you because it's the side of Jeff Gehrman's house where Mr. Gehrman's body was ultimately found. And that image was in Mr. Tellis's phone. Detectives also execute a search warrant on the office of Mr. Tellis at the public administrator's office. They search his work computer as well. And in some of the searching on his work computer, they find that he was looking up the make and model associated with Jeff Gehrman's car, which I think is a Honda. So that was found in his work computer as well. And all that, all the articles kind of conclude in like late June of 2022. In July of 2022, Mr. Gehrman does a public records request from the county. And the records request is for more documents and communications from the public administrator's office. And specifically, he's asking for emails between Robert Tellis and an individual by the name of Roberta Lee Pennant. He's asking for all communications and messages on Teams, which is a way, you know, interoffice way of communicating. He's asking for text messages from their cell phones, and he notes, probably as all reporters do, that, you know, you're required as a county agency to respond to a public records request. That request takes place, again, in July of 2022. The county notifies Mr. Tellis that, hey, Mr. Gehrman is requesting additional information from the office, and they're going to work to fulfill that public records request. Mr. Tellis responds to the county that he would like to see whatever is going to be provided in the public records request and asks about how he may be able to do so. And then several weeks pass, and there's another communication from attorneys for the county about the public records request. And if you look at the date and time on this, this is a notification from the DA civil employees about that request on September the 1st of 2022 at 5:45 p.m. So that's about 15 hours before the murder occurs. He gets a notification about Mr. Gehrman's request on a calendar. There's an email on the 1st at 5:45 p.m. and about 15 hours later, the murder occurred. In the end, this case isn't about politics. It's not about alleged inappropriate relationships. It's not about who's a good boss or who's a good supervisor or favoritism at work. It's just about murder. And at the end of the presentation of the evidence, we'll ask you to hold him responsible for his conduct.
At this time, we're going to take a recess. During this recess, you're admonished not to discuss or communicate with anyone, including your fellow jurors. And the defense?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Fassbender, you may address the jury in your opening statement.
Thank you. You know, Her Honor has said this morning that the defense may make an opening statement. You discussed yesterday and the day before that the defense may sit, not say a single word, not even ask a single question, not present a single piece of evidence, and be entitled to a verdict of not guilty. Oftentimes, defense attorneys, in presumably at the get-go, appear to be tough cases, sit back, wait, attempt to poke holes at the state's case as it's presented, but we're not going to do that. We're going to stand before you today and tell you what this case is about. You know, Her Honor said this morning when she instructed you that it's upon you and you alone to make inferences from the evidence in this case. And when the evidence is complete and the evidence is closed, we're going to ask you to do that. This case is entitled The State of Nevada, Nevada versus Robert Tellis. So let's talk just a little bit about Mr. Tellis. He's a family man, married, three children. He's a loving father and husband. He's a self-made man. He applied to our law school here, UNLV, and worked doing air conditioning, HVAC. It's a hard way to make a living, put himself through school. In addition to supporting his family and being engaged at school, he became the president of the university bar. It's basically the student body president of his law school. He ran his own probate firm for 3 years and was named Pro Bono Attorney of the Year by the Nevada Legal Services in 2016. He ran for the Office of Public Administrator and was elected in 2019. He was determined at that point in time to clean up the office of the Public Administrator's office. He went in that office with a goal and with a mission. And as we had spoken briefly through the process of jury selection, he kind of upset the apple cart. He started eliminating unnecessary overtime. He wanted the office to run more efficiently. In some cases, we had public employees that are paid by our tax dollars reporting 40 plus hours per week of overtime. And let me tell you, his changes at this office were not received well, and that created this hostile work environment. As a result of this hostility, reports were made, as they should be. Obviously, our public and our duly affected, our elected officials should be looked upon. Comes job. In Mr. Gehrman's first report, it states, among the changes, Tellis has said he made are closing estate cases faster and cutting back on large amounts of tax-funded overtime employees are getting under Cahill. He provided a document that showed one veteran where he received more than $140,000 in overtime between 2017 and 2018. That was on the top of the employees' combined $150,000 regular salary for those years. The employee overtime dropped to roughly $13,500 in 2020, which you see is a substantial reduction, according to the doctor. Cole Lofton, an estate coordinator for the past year, said old guard acts like a little gang and has tried to isolate. Lofton said she has suffered from migraines and from stress. They told me from the beginning, pick a side, she said, adding that Tellis does everything he can to help her succeed while the other group wants her to fail. Again, that was the source, that was the seat of his hostile, allegedly hostile work environment. After being duly elected, Mr. Tellis also began evaluating the ethic of the office's relationship with her third-party vendors. And you're going to hear that through the course of this case, because perhaps the state wants to make things simpler. This was part of the facts and the evidence from which you will be called upon to draw inferences. He set out to identify the suspicious nature of business conducted by outside facilitators administration operating under the independent administrations. And we need to just discuss this a little, because the RJ did a very good job following up on this and reporting these problems. You have people who die. They don't have wills. They may not have heirs. They may not have estates. And unfortunately for them, their legacy is stolen by these third parts. Generally, if a person dies intestate, it goes to the administrator's office, and they deal with the affair, which often involves the sale of homes. Under this Independent Administrations Act, there are third parties who would come in, oftentimes with no announcement. Family members take the properties, devalue the property, and then turn around and sell them, and then to a straw buyer, and ultimately sell them again and make millions of dollars. Robert Tellis was determined to stop that, regardless of consequence. What we saw here and what he saw when he was basically corporate interest over public interest in the state of Nevada. We all experienced that every day from a basically the national bird, the cones, to the casinos, sucking money out of our society for their own gain. And that was occurring at the public administrator's office when Robert Tellis was elected. In his review, he discovered the public administrator's office had been favoring Compass Realty in the distribution of home sale contracts. Again, he was upsetting the apple cart. He saw this relationship really a violation of Nevada law and the code of ethics governs office. He also discovered that Compass Realty was using the straw buyer again to conduct this business and to hide their activities. It was an inherent conflict of interest. And Mr. Tellis was not going to stand still for this. In March 2022, Mr. Tellis contacted the duly elected attorney, Steve Wolfson, and he wanted to report his findings to Mr. Wolfson. Now, Mr. Tellis was an elected official, so was Mr. Wolfson. It's appropriate Mr. Wolfson to give an audience. Mr. Tellis called, explained his concerns. Mr. Wolfson put him in contact with a detective, Jap, Metro and Tellis officer, who generally investigated public corruption. Mr. Wolfson felt that Detective Jappy could be of assistance to Mr. Tellis in this investigation. Mr. Tellis felt that laws were being broken and people were being stolen, error being stolen from by these third parties. Mr. Tellis accepted this referral and contacted Mr. Jappy. Again, from the cellulite extraction, we have records to corroborate. Hi, Detective, next time you call back, I'm hanging up on anyone else if I'm on a call because it's very important to Mr. Tellis to get this investigation underway. Mr. Tellis put together a very exhaustive investigative report to expose this corruption. It was sent to Detective Jappy on March 6, 2022, and it names the individual that Mr. Tellis was primarily concerned about. It contained evidence, exhibits. It contained proof of this corruption that previously his office had turned a blind eye to, and it was the prior guard and ultimately the subsequent guard that went back to the same practices that would concern Mr. Tellis. Mr. Tellis and Detective Jappy agreed to meet and further discuss the possible bribery and the corruption conspiracy that was occurring in his office. Again, the meeting was unavailable, but nonetheless, Mr. Tellis tried to follow through and is basically saying, hey, we need to get together. I need to provide this information to you and discuss the same. Detective Jappy turns the email, texts, and says, no worries. Again, Mr. Tellis is following and wants to expose Russia. During their meeting, and they ultimately met, Detective Jappy agreed that Mr. Tellis should continue his investigation and that Detective Jappy would assist in building a case of bribery and corruption. And see, the reason this is important, and we will get there as we begin to unfold this story for you, is there became to be some irregularities, which we are going to present to you. And again, you are called upon to make your inferences from the state of the evidence. In reference to one of these three individuals contained within his exhaustive report, Mr. Tellis states, hey, Derek, I'm supposed to have a meeting with this individual and her counsel next week. If you think I try and need to get any specific statements, please give me a call to discuss. He responds, thank you, sir. We'll reach out tomorrow. Detective Jappy initiated his own investigation and began surveillance. So we have police actors, metro actors, now acting as a consequence or as a result of Mr. Tellis's effort. And we have this surveillance that occurs on April 27, 2020. And this surveillance, because of what Mr. Tellis was doing, Metro Intelligence was getting involved. Because of this involvement, because of this independent investigation that Mr. Tellis had initially begun, the old guard at public administrator's office began to push back. Oftentimes, as human beings, we're not happy, especially when it affects the bottom line of other people. That's what occurred in this office. In addition to their hostility towards the new employees brought in, Rita Reed and her supporters began following Mr. Tellis to dig up dirt. They captured images, which you saw in the state's opening statement, of Mr. Tellis and Miss Lee Kennan getting out the back of the vehicle and used this to persuade Jeff Gurman to invest. Now, Jeff Gurman has been in this community for a lot of years, and if he's presented evidence on other side of the equation, he looks into it, and he did as a result of this old guard trying to reach Tellis. During their investigation, and that being the old guard, Rita Reed announces that she will oppose Robert Tellis in the upcoming election for public administrator. 2 weeks after the first article is published, she receives a campaign contribution, Compass Realty, Adam Fenn, totaling $10,000. And oftentimes you hear, follow the money. Well, that's what Mr. Tellis asked Detective Jappy to do. At this point in time, and this is curious, and this runs into this murder investigation, Detective Jappy pivots. Initially, he's looking at the true bad actors in this case, but he pivots and begins looking at Robert Tellis, the whistle, the person who initiated this investigation and who's trying to bring Metro in to investigate the wrongdoing. Hey, sir, two things. Just wanted to know we are still working on what we've talked about and starting to get a better understanding of what's going on. Second, saw the article today and just want to make sure you're all good. Now, this is in reference to that first article Mr. Garman wrote. And this is Detective Jappy communicating with Mr. Tellis. Mr. Tellis responds, thanks, I'm hanging in there. I'll forward you the truth of the matter. It states that, and that's just how Mr. Tellis was feeling, the RJ wants to drag me to the mud. I told the reporter everything, but of course that doesn't sell papers. Detective Jappy responds, again, we have May 16th, you'll see at the bottom. I understand that completely. Sorry you have to go through this, but the truth will always come out and prevail. And through the course of this trial, Mr. Tellis is going to ask for you to be willing to let prevail. This is of concern. Now, on June 23rd, 2022, 2022, Kimberly McMahon, a former real estate agent, provided services for the public administrator, reaches out to Alicia Goodwin, the member of the old guard.
All right.
We have an email indicating that. Again, we have Goodwin, who's part of the old guard, and we have Kimberly McMahon somehow getting involved in influencing Detective Jappe. We have Kimberly McMahon, who is a former real estate agent and officer, wanting to get together and discuss these articles and what's going on in the public administrator's office. This goes so far that on 8-9, Detective Jappe is approached by me. It's our belief, and we believe this will be disclosed through the course of this trial, that Alicia Goodwin and Rita Reed put her up to this. McMahon states, and I will submit to you that there will be no evidence produced. This is true. But McMahon told Jappe that there is some attempt to receive kickbacks in exchange for real estate listing for the public administrator's office. So again, the very thing that he's accusing others of is getting turned on him. And we're having Detective Jappe. We have Metro pivot. And Ms. McMahon gives a formal interview with Jappe. So we're now, again, having this pushback from the old guard as a result of Mr. Telesol and calling in. I mean, we have this gentleman that's on trial in this case calling in for the assistance of Metro to discover and expose his corruption. This is what's really important. At the time of the alleged solicitation of kickbacks, where she's claiming that that man is soliciting kickbacks from her, so she's kind of got a dual thing going on. At the time, she's a lieutenant of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department and also a real estate agent. We're to believe that a public official is trying to solicit bribes from a police officer, and I'd submit to you that the facts will show and common sense will dictate that that's just absurd.
More continuing coverage in the Las Vegas Reporter murder trial of Robert Tellez is on the way. From the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today, press subscribe now.